the fact that you are here to express here the views that you've been hearing is a very distinctive intellectual and political development. I don't know if such a meeting would take place in New York or Washington, but I'm very glad to take part in it. I'm going to talk about developments in the United States. As many of you know, since the attacks of 9/11, I've been one of those writers in the United States who drew attention to the similarities and the differences between the Nazi, fascist, and communist forms of totalitarianism and those of the Islamists. I've been joined in that effort by, among others, Fuad Ajami, Paul Berman, Russell Berman, Robert Lieber, Andre Markovitz, and the editors of the Washington Post in particular, in efforts to get the political center, the center-left and the center-right, people who believe in liberal democracy and the market economy, and the mixed economy, including liberals and moderate conservatives, to speak frankly about radical Islam and its affinities to the previous forms of totalitarianism. And in Europe, there have been key voices in that effort, including Matthias Kunzel, as we've heard today, my friend Bassem Tibi, and the French writer, the Algerian writer, Boualem Sansal. Our efforts have failed. We do not know how the tweets of Donald Trump will turn into the foreign policy of the United States of America. The election of Barack Obama in 2008 ended an effort to make the issue of radical Islam or Islamism, including the anti-Semitic ideology of the Iranian regime, a matter of acceptable discussion within the Democratic Party in the United States and among liberal scholars, intellectuals, and journalists who supported Obama. Hillary Clinton's decision to become the Secretary of State meant that the most important potentially dissenting voice in the Democratic Center had become part of his team, and she supported his policies. Those within the Democratic Party, and most importantly Senator Robert Menendez, who spoke of the link between radical Islam, terror, and the danger of the Iranian nuclear program, remained a small but courageous minority. The Obama-Clinton team focused on Israeli settlements as the barrier to a peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, rather than on the reality of radical Islam and the consistent refusal of the Palestinian Authority to accept Israel and finally do a deal. In the Obama era, the mention of the term radical Islam or Islamism brought criticisms in the universities of Islamophobia, a criticism that intimidated the vast majority of writers and intellectuals. In our era of euphemism in Washington, the Obama administration refrained from stating the obvious, because doing so, it thought, would supposedly offend the millions of Muslims whose support the United States was hoping to gain, or would inflame Americans against Muslims in general, both in our country and around the world. There were no shortage of academics in departments of Middle East studies warning of such disasters, or groups claiming to represent Arabs and Muslims who were quick to warn of Islamophobia and hostility to the religion of Islam in general. And so it was that a president who graduated from Columbia University, had a law degree from Harvard University, and taught at the University of Chicago Law School, those three are among our finest universities in the world, who stressed how nuanced and complex his view of the world was compared to the simplifiers among those who disagreed. This president refused to make a distinction between Islamism and Islam. The result was that for those 8 years, there was no ideological assault on radical Islam or Islamism coming from the government of the United States of America. No war of ideas that complemented the war on the battlefield that so many of our young people, on which so many of our young people bled and died. Obama's decision to proceed with the Iran nuclear agreement was, so many of us argued at the time, an aspect of this larger refusal to take the ideas of radical Islam in both its Shia and Sunni forms with the seriousness they merited. This lack of nuance and the era of euphemism of the Obama-Clinton era has now found its counterpart in the lack of nuance in Donald Trump. a candidate willing to fan resentment against the educated elites who had refused to speak frankly about the issue, and to give a wink and a nod, and sometimes more, to simple ignorance and prejudice against Muslims. The truth that was not coming from the political center now found its expression from an authoritarian demagogue who had no interest in making fine distinctions. Trump made clear that he did not care if someone called him Islamophobic. The message of his campaign was that, yes, the Islamic State certainly did have something to do with radical Islamic terrorism, but also with the religion of Islam. He trafficked in conspiracy theories. He fanned misogyny. Thank goodness for the women in Washington and all over the world this past weekend. He fanned misogyny at his rallies as his supporters chanted that what should happen to Hillary Clinton is lock her up or hang that bitch. He stoked fears about Mexicans and Muslims, and he borrowed in the absolute infamous slogan of the isolationist and anti-Semitic movements of the American 1930s, America First. I almost threw up when, from the steps of the Capitol, in his inaugural address, the new president of the United States bellowed, America First. What Trump will do about radical Islamic terror is hard to discern. He presents a bundle of contradictions and impulses. At times, he sounded like a crank isolationist with no understanding of basic nuclear strategy or the role of America's alliances. At others, he said he likes to win rather than to lose, as if the rest of us preferred defeat. Inexplicably, he expressed admiration for Vladimir Putin, refused to acknowledge facts about Russian intervention in the American election, and appeared uninterested in what Russia and Iran were doing in Syria to aid the Assad regime. He never resolved the contradiction between his enthusiasm for Putin and his determination to wage war on and defeat ISIS. The contradiction is evident in the selection of Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, with extensive business ties to Russia, as well, on the other hand, as General James Mattis, the saving grace of his administration, the only major figure who understands the importance of the Atlantic Alliance and America's global alliances in general. I want to talk a little bit about a man that you may not have heard that much about, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who is now the National Security Advisor of the United States and sees the President of the United States every single morning to give him a national security briefing. Trump's selection of Michael Flynn indicates that we will be hearing a great deal from the Trump administration about radical Islam. The era of euphemism is probably over. It is doubtful that one of the distinctions is upon us. In the summer of 2016, Flynn and Michael Ledeen published a book called The Field of Fight, How We Can Win the Global War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies. And now that Michael Flynn is serving as the National Security Advisor, The Field of Fight tells us what one of the aides that the president will hear every day thinks about U.S. foreign and military policy. I've known Michael Ledeen, Flynn's co-author, for many years. We were both students of George Mossy, the German-Jewish refugee historian at the University of Wisconsin, who wrote many crucial works about the ideological origins of Nazism and fascism. I took George's courses as an undergraduate. In 1972, Michael published the revised version of his doctoral dissertation that he wrote with George Mossy. It's entitled Universal Fascism, The Theory and Practice of the Fascist International, 1928 to 1936. It's a serious work of scholarship, and Ledeen is was a serious historian. He became a conservative long before it was fashionable to do so. He studied and worked in Rome. He worked with Renzo Giannulli. He's written about Italian fascism. He's a serious person. And he's one who's advocated regime change in Iran. He's called the government of Iran a clerical fascist regime. The argument of the field of fight can be summarized as follows. Quote, ever since 9/11, our leaders have done everything in their power to silence criticism of anything Islamic, to the point where, until recently, virtually nobody in public life or in academic circles dared to speak of Islamic terrorists, even when their motivations were utterly explicit, unquote. Hence, quote, the first order of business, unquote, is to, quote, tell the truth about radical Islamists and their allies And that truth is that radical Islamists represent, quote, a failed civilization, unquote, and they are at war with the United States and the democracies in general. Political correctness has forbidden us to denounce radical Islamists, while political and academic elites have dismissed, quote, out of hand, the very idea of waging war against them. No wonder we're losing. They've gotten a free ride. The Western democracies, they wrote, face an alliance of evil countries and movements that are working to destroy them, and the global alliance includes North Korea, China, Russia, Iran, Syria, Cuba, Bolivia, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, as well as radical Islamist organizations such as Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, and the Islamic State. Russia is an important component of this alliance. Somehow, Russian antipathy toward radical Islam does not prevent the Kremlin from constructing all the Iranian nuclear power plants, nor does the doctrinaire communist regime in Pyongyang hesitate to cooperate with Tehran regarding nuclear weapons. Quote, the two most active and powerful members of the enemy alliance are Russia and Iran. As important as Russia is, it is, quote, Iran that is the linchpin of the alliance, its centerpiece. Flynn and Ledeen, most likely the latter, write that Iran was and remains a classic example of clerical fascism, and like a leader of other fascist states, the mullahs who have ruled the Islamic Republic have claimed universal authority in the name of their doctrine and not of their country. And the argument of the book clearly points toward the need for regime change in Iran. The authors rely on a book by a fine scholar who died far too young, dear man, Lauren Muravich, who in 2008 wrote an important book, which I hope will be read here in Berlin, called The Mind of Jihad. And Muravich pointed out that since 1917, the Soviet Union and communists were very able to make connections between anti-imperialism and Muslim extremists. Those are Muravich's words. And more of which, The Mind of Jihad is an important book for Flynn and Ledeen. The point of that is that they understand in this book that Russia and Iran are in a both practical and also ideological alliance. That the secular successors of the Soviet Union do not find it difficult to make common cause with the mullahs in Tehran. So, on the one hand, Flynn and Ledeen understand very well that Russia and Iran are not antagonists, but they are allies. A word about Syria is in order. Trump has refused, as you know, to criticize Putin or Iran for their support for Assad, and he has been indifferent to the slaughter of 300,000 to 500,000 Syrians and the massive refugee crisis the Syrian civil war has caused. In Syria, Bashar al-Assad made clear he would use inhumane methods, which you have seen on television for years, to suppress the revolt. Russia and Iran made clear they would engage in indiscriminate attacks on civilians to win that war, which they are winning. One conclusion from the Syrian civil war could be that the government of Iran was sending a signal to its own population as well, and namely that if it rose in revolt, it would respond with the same level of violence and barbarity that it exercised in Syria. And so anyone such as Flynn and Ledeen who talk about regime change in Iran should be compelled to explain how that could happen without the catastrophe of comparable or even worse dimensions. If Trump continues his pro-Russian policy, which still remains inexplicable to people in the United States, his leverage with Germany and the EU will at least, or the German political establishment around Chancellor Merkel, will diminish considerably. Given Russia's threats to Germany and the EU, why would a centrist German government pay any attention to Trump's by then incoherent saber rattling or his pressure on the West Europeans to increase their far too small defense budgets? And by the way, the Israeli Air Force is larger than the German Air Force, I just learned from Elliot Cohn's new book, The Big Stick, which is very worth reading here. Elliot Cohn is one of the Never Trump moderate conservatives who is not sparing in his criticism of the president. I want to come to bring this to a conclusion. These remarks were written on January 5th, and things have gotten worse since then. In his tweets and in his attacks on the United States Intelligence Agency, Trump gave no evidence that the realities of governing replaced the fantasies of his divisive and demagogic campaign. It is entirely conceivable he will begin with a chaotic and dangerous foreign policy, and that's one prediction that this historian made, which came true. One that unravels decades of American world leadership and that dismisses real threats because he chooses to believe Putin and Julian Assange more than the CIA, the National Security Agency, and the FBI. The talk about the danger of radical Islam, the threat from Iran, and the need to support Israel will sound absurd so long as it is coming from an administration that is giving more credibility to the government of Russia than it is to its own intelligence agencies. And I want to conclude by repeating something I said earlier today. The power of the United States of America rests on the fact that my country is by far the largest, and most sophisticated, and most capable military in world history. Our economy is the envy of the world. Our political institutions inspire people all over the globe who appreciate the value of freedom of expression and pluralism and compromise. And the power of the United States to deter our adversaries and protect our friends depends also on the credibility of the word of the President of the United States. And that when the President of the United States asserts that a certain factual situation exists somewhere in the world, people will believe that president. For example, if the President of the United States says that the government of Iran is or is not fulfilling the terms of the Iran nuclear deal, then it is absolutely essential that the people of the world and of the United States believe the President of the United States is a man who tells the truth, and tells the truth based on fact and evidence. And I come to you tonight to say to you that we have elected a man to the presidency of the United States whose word cannot be taken seriously. And he has made that clear. He went to the Central Intelligence Agency on Saturday, and he spoke in front of 800 members of our intelligence agency, many of whom probably voted for him, and he told them he wasted their time on a Saturday afternoon to tell them that it was false, that there were more people at the protests of his inauguration than at his inauguration itself. He told them to their face things they knew were not true. This is profoundly important. And as I said earlier today, my fear, and I hope I'm wrong, I'm a historian and not a seer or a prophet, but my fear is that this man who ran on a campaign to make America great is going to, at least in the near future, make America weaker.